Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Sublimely Gothic, the podcast devoted only to the most sordid and macabre tales ever penned to paper. Here you shall explore the darkest jewels of literature with gothic enthusiasts Amy and Jess. Enter this realm at your own risk, for the night is dark and full of terrors. Welcome to the show, everyone. This is the finale of season 3, as which each finale we depart from our normal template to break down the gothic elements within a mainstream franchise. This episode shall be all about finding the gothic within A Song of Ice and Fire, aka Game of Thrones. And spoiler warnings, if you're not up to date with either the Game of Thrones TV show or have not completed the book series to A Dance with Dragons, this episode may not be for you. You have been duly warned. And unfortunately, Jess, my co-host, could not be here with us, but in her place to talk about Game of Thrones, we have the fabulous gothic bookstagrammer, Elena. Hi, Elena.
Hi, hello.
Elena is from Macedonia and is known by her Instagram tag at MyVampireDiary. It's undoubtedly one of the most stunning bookstagram pages I've seen in a while, and I love it even more because it is specifically devoted to the dark and the macabre. I will put her link in the show notes so that you can check her out. So thank you so much for joining me, Elena.
Well, thank you for having me on your wonderful podcast. I've been a longtime fan and I'm really looking forward to all of your episodes. So,
oh, thank you. And so actually, we've known each other for a little bit to the point that you were supposed to join us for our review of Mexican Gothic last season. But guess what, everyone? Elena got COVID.
Yes.
Screw the world.
Yes, exactly.
So. Yeah. So since then, I've been waiting anxiously to have her on our show. So yay, she's finally here.
Yes, I'm so happy to be here.
Yes. And so, you know, I gave you a choice of what, like, sort of episodes, like I told you what I was covering, and you were most fascinated by wanting to examine the gothic specifically in A Song of Ice and Fire. So tell me, why was that the one that you wanted to, you know, talk about with me?
Well, that's a good question, because I'm a diehard fan of George R. R. Martin, and especially his A Song of Ice and Fire series. So this episode is a combination of two of my absolute favorite things in the world. Mm-hmm. I just couldn't resist.
Yeah. And I'm out of curiosity, did you read the series in English or in your native tongue of Macedonian, or both?
The first time I've read the series, it was in Macedonian, but mm-hmm. I hated the translation. It was awful. So I got the books in English. And yes, I've reread them twice in English, much better mm-hmm. in the original language.
Yeah. No, why was the Macedonian translation so bad? What did they do?
I think that they rushed the translation process and it was literal. The translation was quite literal.
It was not. It was going purely Google word
Translate.
For word, not so much the spirit of the text.
Yes, exactly.
Oh, I see. So I'm just out of curiosity, did you read the books before or after the show started to pick up?
I've read book one, and then I watched the whole show, and then I went back to the series. I mean, the book series. Yes.
Yeah. So I'm very much one of those where I wasn't even like an avid super fan of the show. Like, I only started kind of watching the show until like there were like 5 or 6 seasons into it. And then once it was done, you know, I thought, you know, it's a fantasy series. I might like it. And so I started reading it. And then I realized just how great George R. R. Martin's writing style was. And so, yeah, I just binge read, you know, all of them recently. And actually, I'm only up until like a third into A Dance with Dragons at this point. And it's, you know, I kind of sort of stopped reading it. It was a little low on the pulse, but there is also the part of me, what's the point of finishing? There aren't any more books.
Yeah, exactly. Hopefully the Winds of Winter will come this year. Who knows?
Who knows? But as I always say, I will kill him if he dies before the...
Yes. Yes.
So, yeah. So, I'm just, again, I hope he will finish the series at some point. But we don't know. But let us start examining the Gothic with the books that we have. So... So as I always structure these sort of, you know, Gothic within a mainstream franchise, what I do is I like to take the Gothameter that we typically use with the novels that we cover and just go, you know, category by category and just list every possible thing within the franchise of specialty, this time being obviously Game of Thrones, and just talking about the various elements of why that piece in the series, why that element in the series falls into that category. For the first category in the Gothometer, we have atmosphere and setting. So, Elena, what did you have in that category? Like, I have my notes here, but what did you come up with for that category?
Well, actually, I was quite surprised how much Gothic elements there are in Game of Thrones. Because you... and fans usually see it as a fantasy series, but there are actually a lot of themes and elements explored that fall into the Gothic category. So the first thing that falls into the Gothic setting could be the wall itself.
Oh, so the wall. Like, I put in my notes, one in my list was Castle Black and all of the towers, because, you know, the majority of them are abandoned. Yes. So they're in that state of ruin and decay, which is very Gothic-esque.
Yes, and especially the Night Fort. That's the oldest and the biggest castle built in the wall. And it has...
Oh, the Night Fort. Yes. Is that where Bran and his band of merry men go to get through the wall?
Yes, they
Yes. I'm not a dummy. I still remember.
Yes, so the Night Fort has a sinister past. That's the oldest castle, and I don't know if you remember the 13th Lord Commander, the one who made himself the king and took a wife, a White Walker wife.
Oh dear, yeah. I forgot about that one.
Yes, he had a corpse queen. She was his legendary consort. He was calling himself the Night King. He brought her to the Night Fort and proclaimed her a queen and himself her king. And even he used sorceries to bound his sworn brothers to his will. So yes, there was a lot of sorcery going on the wall.
Yes, indeed. So yeah, Castle Black, and then just every element like kind of beyond the wall, I feel like goes into sort of Gothic, because the forest right beside the wall, like beyond the wall, is called what? The Haunted Forest. It wasn't that creative.
Yes, the Haunted Forest. Yes, that's just beyond the wall. And in fact, the wall can be a metaphor, because it literally divides the civilization and the barbarians, or the wild.
Yes, I've started to read this history book called Iron, Fire, and Ice, which is ultimately, it's sort of a breakdown of various elements of A Song of Ice and Fire, and gives their real historical counterparts within English or other parts of European history. And certainly the wall was one of the first chapters, and again really honing in that how the wall, again, as you said, you know, dividing what is considered barbaric versus the civilized world, and how that was very much a very stark distinction that, you know, the English defined themselves from the Scot.
Yes. Yes,
you know.
And also the wall can be seen as a division, or it divides the supernatural with the non-magical world, because the wall, beyond the wall.
This is true.
Yes.
We can get more into that in the supernatural section. So yeah, definitely the wall is a big part of it, and, you know, as well as Castle Black and all of the ruined towers. You know, obviously, you know, a big part of Gothic literature is the castles, but of course, as a fantasy series, this world is covered with tons and tons of castles, but not all of them have necessarily a sort of gothic streak. So I only kind of picked the ones that were really super gothic, even for this world where castles are large and looming and foreboding. And so I think the one that comes to mind most is Harrenhal.
Oh yes, Harrenhal.
Because Harrenhal is kind of the big, you know, main castle in the series that has this reputation of being haunted and, you know, possessed by demons or ghosts. Like, you know, it's just the legends surrounding it go beyond any other castle in this world, or at the very least in the south part of Westeros.
Yes, and Harrenhal is considered to be cursed. Everyone who owns, let's say, Harrenhal, or who is considered to be the lord of Harrenhal, dies in a very horrible way.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, so we get a sort of legacy curse thrown in there. I actually started reading Fire and Blood, you know, the sort of, you know, his book devoted to the Targaryen history of the Targaryen yes. reign of Westeros. And I actually read like the first, the chapters that surround Harrenhal and how they thought, oh, this, you know, castle is so great. We're so, it's so fortified, such a powerful citadel. No one will can withstand me. And then of course the dragons come in and just burn everything.
Yes, because even the great walls of Harrenhal can't withstand dragon fire.
Yeah. And that's kind of one of the, as I was reading, that's kind of one of the kind of biggest differences between the books and the show, is because, you know, there's the whole sequence where Arya is at Harrenhal and it's horrible and it's miserable and she has her like three wishes or three kills.
Yes.
And so, but the interesting dynamic is, you know, the main person who is like taking care of Harrenhal, whether he's technically the lord or not in the books, is Roose Bolton. But in the show, we get more of that it's Tywin Lannister who is housed in Harrenhal, and Arya has, you know, they make a point to have some sort of interaction between those two.
Yes, in the books, Arya and Tywin didn't actually meet, and she was a servant to Lord Bolton instead.
Mm-hmm. And a cupbearer.
Yes, a cupbearer.
Yeah. But yeah, that's the biggest one of like sort of haunted ones. Like I threw in here just the notion of Winterfell, you know, as potential, like, you know, just more gothic than the rest. Just the whole North in general, by talking about the Wall, the North in general has a significantly more gothic vibe than the South. And it's not necessarily, well, it is partly like the moors, the weather, dark and damp. If it isn't snowing, it's still dark and damp. But just the idea of their whole mindset is significantly more gothic than the rest of Westeros. And that is shown in the Stark, you know, what are the words of their house? Winter is coming. So this overall sense of foreboding, which I definitely think of what is way more gothic.
Yes, and Winterfell has been described as the gloomy castle, or the cold, vengeful spirits of the North always hunger for southern blood. So whoever ventures north and isn't a northern man doesn't survive. Mm-hmm. The armies usually get cold and die and so on.
Yeah. And then of course, and then also I think what also makes the North more gothic in nature is because they follow the old gods, which is a, you know, is a very obvious comparison between Christianity versus paganism in our world. And so the North represents the more pagan, more natural, earth-based sort of spirituality, which kind of goes hand in hand with, you know, Gothic literature, the whole relationship between the Gothic literature and Romanticism, which was about, you know, finding sublimity in nature, which is why this podcast is called Sublimely Gothic.
Yes. Yes,
and so I think that's another element of why, you know, the North is so much more gothic than the rest.
Yes, definitely. And also, in a Bran chapter, we discover that actually there's a tower in Winterfell that has rain-worn gargoyles. So
yes.
It's also very gothic.
Like, yeah, the only sort of castle that I feel kind of can bring any sort of substantial Gothic elements in the south is Dragonstone.
Oh, yes, Dragonstone.
Yeah, just by the nature of there are significant descriptions and extensive descriptions, whether it's from, again, that poor maester who got murdered in the prologue of Clash of Kings, or through Ser Davos. Like, we get a lot of description of these both dragons and gargoyles that are carved just throughout the entire castle, like, all over the place.
Yes, and Dragonstone is made out of volcanic rocks, so it makes it almost all black. Mm-hmm. And it's described as grim beyond a doubt, and it's surrounded mm-hmm. by storms, and the sea is always roaring.
Yes, the castle by the sea.
Yes.
And apart from Dragonstone, at least, like, the only other note I have of, like, sort of atmosphere and setting is this is a, we can, it's debatable whether we put this in supernatural or setting. It can be both. The House of the Undying.
Oh, yes, the House of the Undying.
Like, the what Dany has to go through to get her dragons back.
Yes, that's, that place really gives me the creeps. And it's actually one of my favorite Dany chapters.
Mm.
Because
we... Yeah, no, I was, yeah, really interested in that chapter just to see how it would, you know, contrast between how it was presented into the show and the books. But yeah, just the whole thing about it was super, super creepy. Can you think of anything on, in besides House of the Undying in Essos that could kind of be in the Gothic setting or atmosphere? I'm not thinking of anything, but...
I think that Kart also had Gothic architecture mentioned, like the gargoyles.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Ornate buildings, I believe.
Oh, okay. Yeah, again, it's been a while since I, you know, read Clash of Kings, but that would make sense that it would lean towards the Gothic because the it's like already had Gothic leanings, and then their House of the Undying is yes. the ultimate in the Gothic for within their city.
Yes, but I think that the more Gothic places are present in Westeros than in Essos.
Yeah, because again, Westeros is more based on, you know, Western notions of, you know, Western civilizations, and likewise, that's where sort of Gothic literature took root.
Yes. Also,
can you think of anything else in Westeros Essos for atmosphere and setting?
I think that the Eerie, especially in Sansa's chapters, when she becomes, yes, Littlefinger's daughter, Elaine. I think that's the most Gothic thing in all of A Song of Ice and Fire, because she's exactly like every Gothic heroine, stuck in a tower, in a castle, in the clouds, manipulated by an older man.
Okay, yeah, no, I didn't even think of the Eerie. I did certainly think of Sansa, you know, as the quintessential damsel yes. in distress, which we'll talk about in the heroines, heroines, and villains category. But by extension, extending that to the Eerie, I never really thought about it that way. But you're totally right. And there, yeah, this sense of looming castle, and they have the very specific, you know, moon door that you kill people in.
Yes, the moon door, and plus the sky cells, they're very disturbing.
Ah, yes, yes, and that too. Yeah, I gotta admit, I guess I don't think too much of the Eerie. Like, I like the Eerie better, again, when it's with Sansa as Elaine. Like, when we first see the Eerie with Catelyn and Tyrion, I just didn't like that plot so much, because I just want to scream at Catelyn, like, this is such a stupid idea.
Yes, that was one of the stupidest things that Kat's done in the whole...
Yeah, and again, because she's not a dummy. And so it was just like, why are you doing this?
Yes, she shouldn't have had so much faith in her sister. That turned out badly.
Okay. But other than that, I think we can move on to, you know, the second category in our Gothometer, which is the past. And so the past coming back to haunt the present. That's a huge tenet of Gothic literature. And as in regards to Game of Thrones, one thing that comes to my mind specifically is, of course, the legacy of Robert's Rebellion.
Yes, Robert's Rebellion had such a great impact on everyone, the whole of Westeros, people have made life-changing decisions when they choose their sides, whether to fight for the Targaryens or the rebel Robert, and they've lost so much or won so much. But even the winners were on Robert's side, and even King Robert himself, even though he won the war, he still felt like he lost, because he lost his mm-hmm. love, and there is nothing that can fill his hole, so to say.
Yeah, nothing can fill the void. And yes. Yeah, and just, you know, both on a personal level and the societal level of the implications of Robert's rebellion, because, you know, the past is, we don't know if it's confirmed in the book series, you know, yet. It was something, it was already a pretty established theory of that came to fruition in the show, of the notion of the past of Jon Snow's parentage.
Yes, the popular R plus L equals J theory.
I think that's the nerdiest yeah. abbreviation. But yeah, so the idea of, you know, the sort of, you know, mysterious parentage and actually coming, being the heir to like a vast amount of wealth or a specific castle or estate that you didn't know you could, that you were an heir to, that's totally steeped in Gothic literature. And so Jon Snow kind of represents that element of the past directly in terms of parentage coming back to both haunt you and, again, just create all sorts of complications. Like, I have many, many criticisms of the 8th final season, as we all do. But one thing that I didn't have a problem with was the fact that the whole reveal of Jon Snow being Aemon Targaryen, that he didn't end up being king or didn't end up in any sort of substantial, powerful role. Like, people were really like, what's the point of that? And I, you know, I look at that criticism and I'm just like, this is not, you know, Lord of the Rings or King Arthur. The point is that even as legitimate as his claim is, you know, it's not like, it doesn't mean in this very cutthroat world that he's going to get anything.
Yes, I agree with that. But I'm not a huge fan of season 8, so I'm not going to comment anything further.
Yeah, like, I hated season 8 just as much as anyone else, but that was just one of the few things that I, you know, people complained about, and I'm just like, I was okay with that, because, again, just because you have the claim doesn't mean you get the, you know, if you've read the last or watched the last 7 seasons, that doesn't necessarily... You know, Stannis had, quote-unquote, the right claim. Did he get it? No. Okay. No one complained about that. But anyway, so yeah, the past. And then also the way the past, I think, influences the series is, you know, Aegon's conquest. The whole notion of, you know, by reading Fire and Blood and getting the sense of the Targaryens, just how much they shaped the political, you know, landscape of Westeros, and this notion of, you know, what would their world, Westeros, had continued to be like had there not been these like semi-demigod sort of figures that have dragons that can like just swoop in and kill and, you know, raise the whole countryside. And so, yeah, so just the idea of the past with the Targaryens as the reigning dynasty in Westeros and how their culture has been influenced by that, sometimes naturally and sometimes, you know, grudgingly and, you know, forcefully.
Yes, the Targaryens shaped Westeros in a very significant way, because there were 7 kingdoms, then they were united onto one king. Mm-hmm. And when the people of Westeros see that they no longer have a Targaryen ruling them, they've started crowning their own kings. For example, Robb. He was the king in the north. Then Dorne also wanted to be separate.
And it's a testament to show that just how, like, you know, Robert stayed in power because he was considered, like, the hero for defeating the Targaryens. But, like, the minute after, so we had one non-Targaryen king that, you know, was able to rule for, like, 15, 20 years in relative peace. But the minute that king is gone and you're trying to succeed, and again, it's now been a sort of half or, you know, sort of generation later of there not being Targaryens anymore. And so then you get notions of like, well, screw this. Why should we be part of the Seven Kingdoms? There are no dragons anymore to like coerce us into obedience. So I'm going to be king in the north. I'm going to be king on the Salt Throne. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that.
Yes, definitely. So the people of Westeros can only be united if they have a dragon king.
Mm-hmm. What other elements of the past could you think of?
Maybe the prophecy of Azor Ahai.
Oh, okay. Yeah, tell me more. I didn't think about that.
Yes, well, because George R. R. Martin has made it clear that history repeats itself. And he has many parallels when it comes to stories from the characters in the past with characters that we see in the series right now. So the Long Night has happened once and it will happen again. So we have that the past coming back or similar events will come to transpire. And definitely, like everyone else, I also think that Jon Snow will be the hero, Azor Ahai, and he will have to fulfill the prophecy with the help of Dany, of course, and her dragons.
Yeah, yeah. In regards to prophecy, my last note for like past within Game of Thrones is Maggy the Frog.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, so because it really, you know, again, I'll have to do a separate episode for Cersei's character study, but, you know, with Maggy the Frog giving that prophecy to Cersei, and it's the very classic, almost Greek tragedy-esque story of the person desperately trying to escape a tragic, you know, ending for themselves that has been foretold in many ways, like both Greek tragedy and Shakespeare's Macbeth.
Yes, definitely. Cersei's story reminds me so much of Macbeth.
Yeah, because she's to the point where, again, the biggest thing I can say about, you know, differences between book Cersei and like TV show Cersei is book Cersei is shown to be a lot more erratic, and they kind of portrayed, I loved how Lena Headey portrayed Cersei, but she did portray her as significantly more calm and cunning, whereas book Cersei is much more like neurotic in the sense, again, of this paranoia, which makes sense, again, for her character, but that I just found was a very striking, you know, contrast, that she's constantly living in fear of this prophecy coming to be. And it's to the point that she's completely sabotaging herself with Tommen's rule because she cannot bear the thought of the Tyrells having any influence over Tommen. And even Jaime says, "There are allies. We need them. You cannot keep pissing them off. This is crazy."
Yes, her plan with the Tyrells totally backfired when she put the High Sparrow in power.
Yes. So could you think of anything else for the past category?
Except for prophecies and the Azor Ahai prophecy, I can't think of anything.
Well, again, I guess, you know, we're going to segue into like supernatural, and I guess we can start up the supernatural section that deals with both the supernatural and the past, which is the whole concept of the Three-Eyed Raven.
The Three-Eyed Raven is my favorite character from the books.
So tell me about, it's a both combination of the past and the supernatural. So like, what do you think about what sort of gothic things it has in that Bran's whole story arc, again, the whole concept of having this omnipresent being?
Yes, well, he's literally called the Three-Eyed Raven, so that's quite gothic, the name itself. And when he wasn't the Three-Eyed Raven, when he was Brynden Targaryen, he was a bastard, he wasn't really Targaryen, he was called Blood Raven because he was pale as milk, he has milk white hair, and he had a raven on his right cheek, I believe. It was a birthmark. It resembled a raven. And he dabbled in sorcery. Everyone was afraid of him. They said that he could spy his enemies with ravens, or he could turn himself into animals, similar to Dracula.
Yes, this is true. Yeah. I'm just thinking back to, like, you know, I haven't gotten too much into the books of, again, the sort of, you know, three-eyed raven figure, like, before, you know, Bran. But I have heard of the Blood Raven because I did read a little bit of the novellas in Knight of the Seven Kingdoms.
Yes, they're very amazing. I love them. The Duncan Egg stories are really the best.
Yeah, like all of his shenanigans. And yeah, the Blood Raven does, you know, come up. But the three-eyed raven, that notion of prophecy, omnipresence, just the fact that it's chosen to be a raven, which, as you said, is big in Gothic literature. One of the most famous Gothic poems, The Raven by Edgar Allan Poe. You know, one of my favorite poems of all time. I'm crazy about ravens because my Patronus is a raven.
That's cool.
Yep, and partly why my Harry Potter podcast is called The Rambling Raven Pups.
Yes. So, as you said, he's an omnipotent presence. Maybe that's because ravens in Norse mythology had a significant role, and also in other religions.
Mm-hmm. Hugin and Munin, yes. From Norse mythology. So yeah, going more fully into, you know, supernatural elements, of course, you know, Game of Thrones without the White Walkers. And, you know, there's been whole sorts of articles and commentary about the White Walkers being, you know, a sort of metaphor for climate change. But ultimately, they are like winter zombies, snow zombies.
Yes, they are.
And it's interesting to me, like, the relationship, you know, the sort of literary evolution or folkloric evolution of, like, the sort of undead and zombies and vampires, because very much early on in vampiric folklore, they were more zombie-esque and disgusting and, you know, decaying and things like that. And then with the emergence of Dracula, you get the more smooth, suave, like, sexy sort of vampires.
And the origin of the White Walkers is still unknown in the books, but we had a glimpse of how they were created in the show. So I'm not sure how George will handle that part, whether they will be just zombies. And if they are zombies, why were they made? And who is controlling them, if anyone is controlling them, really?
Yeah, or, again, metaphor for climate change, or just metaphor for, like, uncontainable disease.
Yes, that works perfectly, actually.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, we know nothing about that in our post-2020 society.
No.
So, yeah, the White Walkers. Oh, I'm just trying to think. And then the crazy, you know, there's many parts of Game of Thrones where the magic in it is very, like, ritualistic, which is kind of on brand with Gothic if we think of, like, the sort of occult niche in a way. So, like, one thing I'm thinking of is that, like, sort of, was it Craster, like, ritualistically, like, just leaving his sons out into the wilderness for the White Walkers to have?
Yes, and we have Craster's babies as White Walkers then. And actually, that's exactly what the 13th Lord Commander of the Night's Watch did. He also gave his children to the White Walkers. So we see a parallel there between Craster and the Night's King.
Interesting, yeah.
And the idea that maybe he's a Stark, that makes the possibility of Craster also having Stark blood interesting.
Oh, yeah, interesting. Let's see, I'm just trying to think. I know I'm trying to think of anything intelligent more I can say about the White Walkers. But that's it. Again, it's just the notion of a lot of, to me, zombies kind of fall more starkly in the horror genre than the Gothic genre. Like, throughout my podcast, I tend to be much more on the Gothic side than the horror side, because part of the reason why I don't like the banality of zombies because I just don't like, you know, pointless gore and like blood and guts.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I like by saying I like prefer gothic literature, I'm saying I prefer the more sophisticated, you know, kind. But yeah, it is a part. And again, you cannot ignore the sort of zombie-esque origins of vampires and how they're huge in gothic literature as well.
Yes, and also speaking of zombies, what do you think about the mountain becoming a zombie?
So that's another, I'm glad you asked that, because that was in my notes as part of a supernatural category or tenet is Qyburn's experiments. And so the idea that, in essence, you know, Qyburn has become Dr. Frankenstein, where he's creating this sort of undead monster.
The scariest monster, I think.
Yeah, and, you know, we don't know the nature of how sentient or how cognizant Gregor the Mountain is in his sort of post-Frankenstein state, do we? I don't really think so. We never get any further insight because Cersei only asks Qyburn, like, will it weaken him? And he's like, oh, no. And then and she's like, then I don't care.
Well, Cersei should be afraid. I wouldn't trust a zombie mountain, really.
Yeah, so, yeah, definitely notions of zombies and sort of necromancy, like cheating death, all big tenets of gothic literature. And then, so not so much zombies, but then going into like sort of occultist or what people perceive to be sort of as sort of satanic magic is, I think of the magic performed by Mir Mazdur in the very first book with sacrificing the horse and losing Khal Drogo. And, you know, she's like, you said the horse would be enough. And she's like, I didn't say anything. You assumed that.
Yes, that was one of the scariest chapters. It was scary even though we didn't quite see what was going on in that tent.
Yeah. And then in general, in Gothic, the idea of, it's not really fully explained, you know, when Daenerys gives birth to her sort of stillborn child, Rhaego, he's described as having leathery rings and stuff, and so it's like, as a Targaryen, was she gonna give birth to a little baby dragon thing anyway, or was that purely the corruption of all the crap that Mir Mazdur did? I don't know.
Well, I think, and I've seen that theorized in some articles or on Reddit, I'm not sure where, but some people think that the dragons and the baby switched place. So Daenerys gave birth to the dragon, and the baby actually went to the dragon eggs.
Mm-hmm. Oh, the soul of the baby, if you will?
Yes, the soul of the baby. And that's why her stillborn had wings. And I think that Mir Mazdur said that it looked like the baby was already dead for thousands of years when it was born.
Mm-hmm.
Because eggs were...
Yep.
The dragons were
there. And continuing with those sort of, you know, magical witches, of course, the most important prominent one is the Red Woman, Melisandre.
Yes, she's our favorite witch, if you will.
Yes, she is. I would have loved to dress up as her for Halloween last year, but again, nothing was happening. Like, Halloween was the ultimate, you know, going around touching all this candy that everyone else touches. It's not congruent with a, you know, quarantine and lockdown.
Hopefully this Halloween will be different.
Hopefully. But yeah, the Red Woman, and what can I say about her? Because I was thinking of, you know, supernatural within the Gothometer. Of course, I know there are many supernatural things, but not all of them are necessarily gothic. Just because there's a supernatural thing, that doesn't mean it's more gothic. But definitely, I feel like Melisandre does have that sort of gothic quality, and I think it's purely by her ambience and her demeanor of being, you know, mysterious and extremely a very femme fatale sort of figure, which can occur in gothic literature of, like, you know, an evil stepmother or aunt or whatever.
Or Dracula's bride. Because she's very...
Or Dracula's bride. Yes. I didn't think about that.
Or in this case, Stannis's bride. not really dreadful.
Now it's Tennyson's bride, but yeah. What do you think? What else about the Red Woman kind of makes her more gothic-y? Again, we talked a lot about her. Again, she's the ultimate source of like prophecy and stuff. But what else?
Well, she's old, but appears to be very young. So that's typical of, I don't know, witches or other gothic things. And also,
yeah, I'm thinking of Mother Gothel and Tangled.
yes, quite similar. And she's from Mashai, which is the darkest place.
Yes, and it's the and what does it say? It is the most eastern place of Essos. So she's super quote unquote Orient compared to this very Western centric. World that is Westeros, which again, if I ever do a PhD, I'm gonna do Orientalism in Gothic literature, because you get it in, you know, Dracula, in kind of not having the best images of Central and East and Eastern Europe, you know, where Western, where England and other Western European countries are shoving all of their fears and anxieties on these figures that are coming from whether it's the Middle East or even just Central and Eastern Europe.
Yes, and when I read books that are set in Eastern Europe, because I'm from Southeast Europe, and it's very funny because people are used or shown in a very stereotypical way, and everyone is either a witch or has something to hide. Everything is very sketchy. It's very funny.
It kind of reminds me, because even my own parents are susceptible to those sort of stereotypes and biases, because you know, I went to school in Istanbul, but I did apply to a variety of programs in Europe as well, and one of the schools I did apply to was Central European University in Budapest. And because I thought, oh, it's a really nice school. It's like, you know, it's recognized by a lot of countries. Like, this would, if I could get into that specific program, that would be great. And so I told my parents that I applied to that school. And they basically acted as if I told them I was going to Moscow. Like, they were just like, you know, they're not like West. Like, basically, my parents' definition of Europe ends at Vienna. And it was very shocking to see that, because they were worried that the Serbs are gonna beat me up, and I'm just like, you know, Mom, Dad, the worst thing I have to fear in Budapest are the gypsies and the vampires.
Yes. Well, maybe foreigners saw Eastern Europe as more scary, because yes, people have different customs here and do different things and are more superstitious than the people in the West, I think. I'm not sure. But apart from that, people are people.
Yeah, it can get really embarrassing, because it's just interesting that there's still that carryover of, you know, the sort of, because let's face it, in, you know, in the ignorant average American psyche, Eastern Europe isn't divided between like these intricacies of like the Czech Republic and Slovenia and Macedonia and, you know, Greece. Like, everything is just Russian.
Yes.
And yeah, so, and then we've got that, and then the whole sort of what I like to call the Cold War hangover, which is still something I guess the baby boomers and maybe some Gen Zers still feel, because in my generation, like, the big bad wasn't the evil Russian James Bond villain. Like, for me, the big bad was you know, terrorists from the Middle East, which I've come to see the world as significantly more nuanced, but that certainly I can't deny was a driving force in why I specialize in Arabic and in Turkish and, you know, devoted so much of my time, you know, in the Middle East. But yeah, it's still interesting that in regards to Eastern Europe still carries on. And again, it's interesting that we could think of, like, you know, Melisandre sort of represent that very Eastern, like, more Eastern than any other, you know, character from Essos that we see, because Lord Varys is from Lys, which is one of the Western, more Western islands. So, like, even he's, like that sort of gap isn't as big as going from Westeros to Ashai. And so, you know, in many ways, Melisandre represents all of those, like, sort of old school superstitions that maybe one would assume with Eastern European culture.
Yes, and I wish it was as magical as people think.
Yeah, it's just, yeah, it's so funny to me because obviously as an Istanbul, I had plenty of friends like from Greece, from the from the Balkans and, you know, Bulgaria. So I'm just like, yeah. But anyway, so that's all I had in regards to the supernatural that specifically has a little bit of a gothic flair, like supernatural dragons, of course, like, but I don't necessarily consider dragons at this point to be super uber gothic. Or at least not in the way that they manifest themselves in A Song of Ice and Fire. They're basically like pets at this point.
Yes.
That can rain destruction and fire on you, but still kind of, you know, pets. Minus like to me, pets. What's more gothic is like the architecture of Dragonstone and like things like that.
Yes.
Alrighty then. So we started to touch upon it a little bit in all of our, you know, discussions, but now we're at category 4, heroes, heroines, and villains.
Oh, that's my favorite one. Yeah.
And so this is an interesting category because it got, you know, some gothic literature, especially early 18th century gothic literature, the hero, heroine, villain dichotomy or triangle is just so cut and dry and is so easy to the point that a lot of people have, you know, accused certain characters in early gothic literature of being very two-dimensional and almost cardboard-like. Like in like that it's not so much about the characters as it is about all the like melodrama that befalls them. But in Game of Thrones and Song of Ice and Fire, you know, that's one of the biggest questions of the series is, you know, what constitutes a hero because it's a world of moral gray.
Yes, and that's very interesting because George Martin has commented on Tolkien's idea of a good king, what makes a good king and what's good, because at the end of The Lord of the Rings, Aragorn became a king and he lived a long life and everyone was happy. And he wanted to propose the idea in his books, what makes a good king?
Mm-hmm. Yes. And so, yeah, so in my question, in my notes is again, what constitutes a hero? So in heroes, of course, we have the ones that are most like what we would consider be heroes in like a very cut and dry world would be, of course, Ned Stark, Robb Stark.
Yes, Jon Snow, you know, of course.
Jon Snow, all of the Starks. And then heroines, as you were talking about, heroine Sansa is the quintessential like damsel in distress. So tell me more about what you were talking about, you know, Sansa's journey and then her relationship with Baelish and, you know, everyone and how that helps to solidify her damsel in distress role.
Yes, as I said before, I think that Sansa is the most gothic thing in Game of Thrones because she's literally like the early gothic heroines. She is always trapped somewhere. Someone makes the decisions for her. She was betrothed to Joffrey. And then in the books, she was betrothed to someone else that she didn't have a choice over. And usually men like Littlefinger control her destiny. He's constantly gaslighting her, telling her that she will be safe as long as she's with him. And she is kept from the truth, like many other gothic heroines. But also I wanted to comment on the relationship between Sansa and the Hound.
Sansa, Sandor. Yes. Like, I want to at some point do a whole video essay about the courtly love and how they're a subversion of that trope in literature. But that's, you know, but continue. I love this topic.
Yes, because they're like Martin's version of the Beauty and the Beast or the Phantom of the Opera, because usually Sansa goes for the pretty boys, you know, like Joffrey.
The pretty boy.
Yes. And she thinks that the Hound is very ugly, like everyone else. He's described as very badly disfigured because he has one side of his face burned off. His hair is thinning and he doesn't even have hair on one side. I think that even the one part of his lips is also burned.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like the Phantom of the Opera, similar to that. He's not the classic good-looking guy.
Yeah, but, yeah, again, I've done extensive, you know, research about this, about that relationship in preparation for this video essay that I want to do, that that definitely Sansa, you know, even as early as book one, she's like terrified of Ilyn Payne on the King's Road. And then she sees the Hound and he's like, yeah, she's like in her head, she's even thinking, yeah, the Hound is ugly, but he's nowhere near as bad as Ilyn Payne.
Yes. And it's very interesting because Sansa always thinks about him in her chapters. She knows that he's not a knight because he makes that clear so many times. He doesn't want to be a knight because his own brother is a knight and he's the worst.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
Titles mean nothing. Even though he's not a knight, he's considered to be a dog, he's a hound, he follows orders, but he's always nice to Sansa in the sense that he never hits her. All of Joffrey's guards harm her.
And he doesn't.
He doesn't. And, yes.
And he does in his own way try to, you know, shield Sansa from the worst of Joffrey's sadism. And there's just little gestures here and there, which again, I'm honing in on specifically for this video essay that I want to do. But in regards to, yeah, I think you're absolutely right that Sansa is that, in a way, I think she's even more of a damsel in distress because if you've listened to my previous episodes, I tend to make the argument in early Gothic literature that that the early heroines are not necessarily, I don't know what's the word, they're not as helpless. Like, they are using their agency, like in Castle of Otranto, in, you know, in Mystery of Udolpho. They are using their agency to run away. Yes, they're in a very limiting, you know, social space where their legal power and their social capital is limited, but they're still using the physicality of running away to exercise some form of agency. And I tend to want to give them more credit for that than maybe some people traditionally do when they look just at a glance at 18th century Gothic heroines. But in that sense, you know, even with me being very forgiving and, you know, open-minded to seeing that sort of agency in the early Gothic heroines, not even Sansa demonstrates that. Like, she had, again, I don't know the exact circumstances. Like, you know, Sansa wasn't in a position to directly run away the way Arya got a head start because Cyril Farrell helped her. But yeah, so she does try constantly think about escape, and she uses Ser Dontis, I think, you know, and clings on to him to escape. But definitely it's something she wants, but beyond purely relying on Dontis or, you know, by extension, Baelish, she doesn't think anything about, like, okay, how can I, like, she doesn't do any sort of, okay, I'll smuggle money so that I'm prepared to, like, leave. She doesn't do anything like that. So in a way, she's even more of a damsel in distress.
Yes, and she always, she's very naive. Well, I think that she's 13 years old in the books, or 14. Mm-hmm. So I see why she's so trusting, so naive. She hopes that perhaps Littlefinger will treat her nicely. And she even had a hope for Cersei being nice to her. So that says a lot.
Yeah. And then the opposite of that, like when as we're talking about it, I think of Daenerys being the sort of like figure in Gothic literature of like the wise widow.
Yes. That's a good description of it. Yes, the wise widow.
Yeah, because she ends up, you know, because it was in Victorian times, it was very common. It could have totally happened that you could just get married and then all of a sudden your husband died, whether in the Napoleonic Wars or, like, well, that was Regency era, but in a variety of ways, wars, you know, disease, whatever, it could be totally happen that you just got married and then your husband dies. And then what is your role in society? And in a way that they have the sort of social capital of being married, and so the society gives them a little more you know, power than young unmarried women. But yeah, you know, Daenerys kind of shows that, you know, using that sort of widow status to her fullest advantage, and or in some ways using the freedom that comes with widowhood and taking the fullest potential from it.
Yes, that's right. I totally agree with you. Daenerys definitely used everything, every resource to her advantage.
So we talked about heroes, heroines, the villains, again, so sort not as, you know, black and white on who the villains are, but we can kind of, at least I think, Cersei definitely falls in the sort of villain camp.
Yeah, villain category, Cersei. She's a very complex character, because when you read her chapters, you kind of see where she's coming from.
Oh yeah, like you totally get why she's so mad and hates the world and hates everything and everyone around her.
Yes, you know, she's had an awful marriage with Robert.
Had an awful marriage, had an awful father who she's constantly trying to get the approval of and she never can. And yeah, just all of those things. And then Tywin Lannister, of course, definitely a big villain. The Boltons, flaying people. I feel like that's very horror gothic.
Yes, especially Ramsay, of course.
Yeah. But in terms of, like, I guess this is, again, kind of, again, because it's so not black and white, this sort of devolving less into heroes, heroines, villains, and just more interpersonal relationships in general. But one thing that I think is very important to discuss is, you know, the incestuous relationship of Cersei and Jaime, because in a way that's a huge part of a lot of gothic literature, both classical and modern.
Yes,
it's so common in gothic literature that there are some books that, you know, they'll make any sort of subtle suggestion and I'm gonna be like, oh, this is gonna be a brother and sister relationship and they're gonna find out and they're gonna be grossed out and it's gonna be all of this thing. It's so stereotypical. And again, but gothic is a very specific niche, and I feel like that in this sort of fantasy series of this popularity and magnitude, it's kind of the first of its kind where incest has been brought in as a point of character development and plot and whatever in a huge way for very popular literature.
Yes, it was very strange to see such a thing on screen, especially because it was a popular show and everyone was shocked, like, what are we watching? But yes, as you said, incest and incestuous relationship are very common in gothic literature. And even Jaime and Cersei, their parents were cousins.
Yeah, they were first cousins.
Yes, they were first cousins. So Joffrey is a product of two generations of incest.
This is true. Yeah. And again, I just don't know the sort of sociological or literary, like, origins of why incest became such a thing. Because obviously the general notion of just even, like, sort of talking about sex or expressing sexuality, like in Dorian Gray and Dracula, you know, that was a huge thing of, like, breaking taboos. And I guess by extension, just the notion of incest was also a means of breaking that taboo and just being sort of just shocking for the sake of it.
Yes.
Not that I condone incest by any means, but I'm just always curious about why people in these periods were so scandalized by brother and sister incest when they married their own cousins anyway.
I don't know.
Like, I genuinely don't get it. Here, let me just bring my cat in. He's crying. Oh. Okay, I'm back. And I remember with J.R.R. Martin, I think he said at once that in the beginning he was thinking of maybe doing an incestuous relationship between Jon Snow and Arya.
Oh no. That would
be so when I read those like passages of Jon Snow and Arya being affectionate with each other, I was just like, yeah.
No, no, no. That's a big
Yeah, but that's just definitely just the whole incest of Cersei and Jaime. Like, taking a trope that's so embedded in gothic literature and the fact that it's such a prominent part of a very, very popular, successful fantasy series I just find really fascinating.
Yes, it's quite interesting.
And then, so, and then I think we can move on to category number 5 for the Gotham Meter, which is mystery. So, I don't know, it's hard for me because I've read these books after, you know, the TV show, so I knew what was coming and what would happen. So maybe you can tell me your experience. Like, what was your experience with the mystery element of, like, trying to guess what would happen when you were reading the books for the first time?
Well, in the first book, we have the murder mystery of who killed Jon Arryn.
Yes.
And we all think that it's the Lannisters, or who pushed Bran out of the tower, but that wasn't a mystery to the reader, but more to the characters.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if there were other...
Yeah, definitely this is the weakest of all the sort of gothic categories for Game of Thrones, because I feel like when we think of, like, murder mysteries, like, we think of them as being very individual, and we think of that one detective, like, asking people questions, but just in the nature of the scope of Game of Thrones, it's not so much about one person was murdered and had a very specific motivation. Like, those murders have very wide-reaching political implications that affect the whole region, if not farther than that.
Oh, I just came up with one. There is a mystery of why the last dragons died. I'm not sure if that was mentioned in the Fire and Blood or the Princess and the Queen prequel.
Why the last dragons died?
Yes, well, it says that... the common people rebelled and they broke where the dragon slept and they killed all of the dragons. But many fans think that there is a conspiracy behind it and there is a mystery. Some believe that the maesters from the Citadel decided that magic was too dangerous, Targaryens are too dangerous, and that they conspired to have the dragons poisoned, so the dragons were weakened by poison, so that the common people would be able to kill them off.
Yeah. And then, of course, the biggest mystery, which unanswered in the books, but answered in TV show, who is Jon Snow's parents? Yeah, that was a big part of it. And then I don't really consider the Red Wedding a mystery. It's like, it was shocking, but it wasn't like, I think you realize very quickly, like, who was responsible and who did it, yada, yada, yada. Again, the mystery of the origins of the White Walkers. Yeah.
Yes, and also the origins of the Targaryens and why they have such a special bond with dragons.
Yes, we do not know that really that well, do we?
I've read that the Targaryens... are maybe an artificial race, or not just Targaryens, but all of the dragon lords in Valyria, and that they were created by blood magic in Ashai, so they have a dragon soul or some part.
So they're like dragon Frankenstein monsters?
Well, in some way.
In a way?
Yes. Yes. That they have dragon's blood in them, in the literal sense.
Interesting.
Yes, and also the Doom of Valyria. That's another mystery. How it happened. Because no one is sure why Valyria exploded. It said that the volcanoes or the 13 flames, or I don't know what was the number of the volcanoes.
So it just all blew up like Pompeii?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
That's the history of Valyria. One day it all just blew up. And no one knows why, and whether it was a natural thing or something more magical happened.
Interesting. Yeah. Yeah, but I think the mystery category is sort of the weakest, because I feel like in traditional gothic literature, the mystery is, again, a gothic novel. It doesn't have the same, like, scope. It's more like individual based, where a person like goes visits the haunted castle or the haunted mansion or the opera house. Like, the setting in a gothic literature, traditional gothic novel, is so condensed that it helps to foster that sense of the traditional, like, murder mystery, because you're asking, like, you know, you're asking people specifically individual questions, which, again, the closest we come to that is the is Ned Stark and his own inquiries of what John Arryn was like researching before he ultimately died. But again, just the nature of the huge scale that and major epic in which Game of Thrones is structured and the story is trying to tell at that macro level that makes the mystery elements significantly weaker.
Yes. We don't have that intimate mystery moment, as you said.
Yeah. Hi. Can you think of anything else with mysteries?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. Alrighty then that goes over all of our, you know, categories in Gothometer. And I think I would like to close the episode with a little random rereading. So I've got my copy of Game of Thrones. I'm gonna just pick a passage at random and read it. Okay. As Iria and Jiqui helped her from her litter, she sniffed and recognized the sharp odors of garlic pepper scents that reminded Dany of days long gone in the alleys of Tyrosh and Moor, and brought a fond smile to her face. Under that, she smelled the heady, sweet perfumes of Lys. She saw slaves carrying bolts of intricate, mirrorish lace and fine wools in a dozen rich colors. Caravans, guards wandered among the aisles in copper helmets and knee-length tunics of quilted yellow cotton, empty scabbards swinging from their woven leather belts. Okay, so this is page 490. So I'm assuming that she's in Vas Dothrak and all the merchants are like coming in, or she's in one of the markets. I assume this is before she's like, they attempted to, this is right before she's about, the merchant attempts to poison her.
Okay.
Yeah. Gothic literature, the only thing it makes me think of is, and I think you read this book, but you said on your Bookstagram that you didn't like it, The Woman in Black.
Oh, yes. It's not that I didn't like it, but I've read many reviews that said it was scary and that people couldn't sleep at night after reading it. And I'm very easily scared by things. And I had my expectations very high. And when I read it, I just didn't feel it. Didn't feel the...
Yeah. Yeah. But what I wanted to say, specifically, I remember when I went over Women in Black with Jess in the podcast and reading it, is there is this one sort of brief reprieve from all the dark tension going on. And it's the marketplace, like in the town square, where, you know, I forget the lawyer's name, Arthur Kipps.
But he
kind of spends the morning or like early afternoon in this market, and just all the descriptions of, you know, people going about town, going about their business. And so it made me think of, you know, that passage made me think of that. It's just, I don't know, the joy of retail therapy.
Yes.
Yeah. But yeah, that's the only element that I could think of in tying it to Gothic literature. That's what it made me think of. Did you have any comments of that specific passage?
No, I can't really think of anything that's related to Gothic.
Alrighty then. And that concludes the season finale of Sublimely Gothic. Thank you so much for joining me, Elena.
Thank you so much for having me. It was such a pleasure.
Yes, and this, at least for the moment, this is going to be the last ever episode of Sublimely Gothic. I can't say I'll never pick up this podcast again, but I have a lot of other podcast projects going on. I've got Rambling Raven Puffs with Jess, covering Harry Potter, and then very soon, starting in September, I will be starting a Game of Thrones Song of Ice and Fire podcast, chapter by chapter things as well. So everyone stay tuned for that. Talk to you guys later. Bye.